Hey everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of No Way. We are back to regular programming this week with the intelligent, eloquent, all-around gem of a human being that is Omari Newton. Outside of his illustrious theater career, Omari is best known for his work on sci-fi's Continuum, Max Steel on Disney XD, and Spike TV's Blue Mountain State. Omari lends his voice as the Black Panther in the animated Marvel superhero adventure series, that is fucking cool, and Corvus in the Emmy Award-winning Dragon Prince on Netflix. Catch Omari as a speaker at this year's TEDx Whistler Talk on September 12th, and next year you can catch Omari's new writing ventures with the radio play Redbone Coonhound at the Arts Club Theatre Vancouver, and also his play Black and Blue Matters with Black Theatre Workshop in Montreal. I just also wanted to take this moment to thank all of you listeners that have made this summer really special for us here at the No Way Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and supporting us. If you haven't already, please take a moment to review us on Apple Podcasts or your other favorite podcast platform. It really, really helps us attract other listeners and get viewership on those pages. So give us 5 stars, maybe 4. Maybe if you want to give us 1 star, don't go and do that. And a heads up, we will be taking a month-long hiatus in September to prep for the next block of No Way episodes. So we will see you all in October, maybe for some spooky episodes. Who knows? Okay, now let's go to the movies.
Welcome to the show, Omari. How are you today?
I'm doing great.
I got a question for you right off the bat. How many jobs have you done already today?
Oh.
How many Zoom meetings have you already had today? Because Omari Newton is one of the busiest human beings I've ever met in my life. How many jobs have you already done today?
Okay, this is actually kind of funny, and this is not an exaggeration. I did 3 voice auditions. I worked my regular full-time 9-to-5 job. I had a meeting about another project and 2 Zoom meetings for work. So that's my day so far.
I knew that would not disappoint. That question would not disappoint. And now you're going to spend some time with us talking about movies.
Omari, what's your 9-to-5 job?
I am a senior instructor at the Vancouver Film School for the past like 2 months.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, man. It's great. Yeah, I was like, how do I make my life more stressful? What do I... It's like, I'll be responsible for melding young artists. That's what I'll also do.
So there's no introductions that are really necessary here. All 3 of us know you really well, and we've worked with you professionally through the theater world, and you and I do some directing whenever we can together. So it's just nice to see you here, and we get to hang out, and no one needs to get to know each other too much. But
for me, on top of just working with you professionally, Omari, and we're not going to get into and explain what happened at all with the job that we all experienced together, but all we have to say is we went through an experience together that was some kind of religious awakening during a show, and that is what we will carry to our graves all together, and
religious
we'll remember.
Awakening?
Yeah, kind of.
That's to say harrowing. Harrowing was a word.
Well,
Arkin really
found
in.
God somehow.
But it's sort of a... Oh, go on. Sorry.
I know, I was just saying, my religious awakening is I was staring death down the barrel. That's what it felt like to me. So yeah, I maybe did see God.
And you guys are quite literally responsible for the resurgence of my theater career. I was done, as you guys know. Like, I legitimately thought I was never going to act on stage again. And it actually it also literally launched my professional directing career, because I wanted to work with you guys, and the project was so cool that I was like, yeah, I'd love to be part of it. And my light just collapsed. That's the spirit of He Who Will Not Be Named was listening and was like, I'll show you guys.
Did you ever title it, like, there's the reconnaissance? Did you ever create your what was the word for your
for your
comeback? The Amaris?
Oh,
is it the
coming out of depression? I don't know. What do you
Well, as long as it was joyful on the other end.
Yeah.
Would you please tell us what movie you've brought to the show today?
I have brought The Goonies. It's one of these movies that I feel like everybody who's like around my age, I'm turning 42, feels like they have a memory of. And then I rewatched it and I was like, oh, I did not remember that.
First, you gotta do the truffle shuffle.
I mean, you watched it recently and it didn't line up with your memory, but did you have an existing memory of when you first saw it and what that movie meant to you at that time?
Yeah, I just remember, obviously, the sense of just wonder.
Goonies never say die!
And the sense of like adventure. It's like the ultimate, if you were a kid and you went on an epic adventure for treasure, this is what you wanted to be like. It had water slides. It had a friendly monster. It had like cool gadgets that you could kind of make out of stuff lying around your house. And like really adult humor that would never fly in 2021.
The only thing we serve is tongue.
No. The kids, you know, the kids got to say wild stuff. Yeah, I just remember it being this really fun adventure movie.
I noticed upon watching it recently that they obviously got the green light to say shit in this film.
Oh, shit!
And they, like, leaned in. They were like, and they probably were like, how many?
Holy shit!
How many exactly can we have?
Oh, shit, what?
They figured out a way to do so.
There's like a rule that you can say shit a number of times and still get the PG-13 rating.
Shit, Ma.
And so they maxed it out.
Shit!
Completely on this movie.
Yeah. Oh, as a kid, you just felt like you were like doing something naughty. Like, oh, they're swearing in this. This is like an adult movie.
I was thinking about this film, but this tradition of this film for me kind of lines up with the Monster Squad and that tradition of the group, the gang, the squad, the club film. And I wanted it so bad when I was a kid, but I mean, I don't even know if it really exists, but did any of you, did you, Amari, did you have like the group of kids who were your group and you had like, they'd come to your house or you'd go to their house always and there was a clubhouse and it's presented in Goonies?
I definitely had a crew of kids and it was like pretty comedic. So I was born in Montreal in Côte-des-Neiges and then we moved to Pierrefonds, which is like a suburb of Montreal. But my group of friends were literally, it was like, you know, my parents were from Trinidad and Tobago and I was like the black kid. And I remember Jimmy Wong lived across the street. He was Vietnamese. Justin Jaster was like Polish. He lived here. I'm not even making this up. Yorgos Trifonopoulos was the Greek guy.
I want the Villa Scalapin.
and then it was Ozer and Umer Kadir lived down the street and they were Pakistani. Like we had like the United Nations crew of people who like did everything together. And
so did you see yourself in this movie? And that's kind of like why it is actually really special, because did you each like identify with a certain character or personality throughout that as well?
So I have always been a total coward when it comes to adventures and stuff. So I think it was more aspirational. I would never go on an adventure. But I was like, man, those kids doing that thing I would never do look like they're having a lot of fun.
I'm so envious though of like that sense, that feeling of a solid group in that age range, and that you know who's going to be hanging out with you at the end of school. You know who's going to be in the hanging out with you in the weekend for sleepovers. I never had it. It was always like we moved around a little bit, and friends were a little more transient. But I realized when rewatching Goonies, it's informed every decision in my adult life. I think it's why I went into theater, because I was like, you have to hang out with me for long periods of time. You know,
jerk alert.
You have to do a podcast with me now.
Making podcasts so people will have to talk to me once a week. Like, I honestly think I just have, all my adult life, I've just been trying to make clubs. Just get that Goonies vibe.
That's interesting. I don't know. I just assume that everybody, I guess that speaks to a certain degree of privilege, right? Like, my parents immigrated from Trinidad and they were just like, we're making a go at it in Montreal.
Our parents, they want the best of stuff for us.
So we moved a couple times, but not always. Like, actually, my older sister got screwed because I have a twin sister as well. And my parents were always like, We'll stay here till the twins finish school. So my older sister kept getting yanked out of her group of friends. But my twin sister and I, we got to make really tight bonds with people. And what I'm trying to say, K-Bon, is sorry you didn't have friends growing up. I was really cool.
Yeah.
But I was will really... you guys be in my club now?
Yeah, you know, it's a constant thing on this podcast. We're like talking about a lot of kids' movies and K-Bon, you know, we're like, oh, we had a great time. I had a group too. And it comes to K-Bon, he's like, no, I didn't have that at all.
Rock-a-bye baby on the treetop.
Yeah, I always feel guilty being like, I had like a diehard group of like bike gang crew.
Like, I almost don't even want to say what my experiences was just to make K-Bon feel worse, because we do it every two episodes, I feel. And so
we would like explore unfinished houses and like haunted hospital. Like, literally, me and my friends would get on our bikes and go explore fucking haunted hospitals. Like, it was the Goonies, you know?
I'm not trying to be a downer about it. I had a great childhood, but now that we're here, when my parents divorced at the age of 8, no.
Oh boy. Yikes.
Is your mommy here?
I mean, I think though that you're right, Cave, or Mari, that like, it's the aspiration of this movie that is like the best part about it, because we all as kids watched it, and that's the success of the movie, is I want to be those kids. I want that adventure. And like, it's really what the movie is to me, is like a kid's fantasy through and through.
I totally think that's the case. And also the kids get to be the heroes and the ones with the plan and the ones with the answers. And it's not to get too deep into it, but it's also like this sort of like anti-capitalist movie where it's like these rich developers.
Oh, no, I see it now.
The whole premise of the movie, right, as you guys know, these rich developers are like taking over the town.
Spoilers.
I mean, it was 1985, people. If you're watching a podcast about Goonies, you haven't seen it yet. This is on you. So,
what are you doing?
We get a call from like a 78-year-old guy who's like, I've been waiting my whole life.
I didn't know they'd find the pirate.
But like, yeah, the parents seem like totally out of their depth. They don't know what to do. And the kids are like, we're going to figure this out. We're going to find this treasure, and then we'll get some money, and then we're going to save the day. And it's, you know.
Because this is their time. Down here.
Oh. Yes.
Down here, it's our time. It's our time down here.
The Goonies was released June 9th, 1985. It runs for 114 minutes. It's written by Chris Columbus, with story by Steven Spielberg, and is directed by Richard Donner. So Richard is also known for 1978 Superman. He's known for Lethal Weapon, The Omen, Scrooged, to name a few. Quite a successful director. Executive produced by Steven Spielberg and Kathleen Kennedy. And I mentioned them because it's like they're the duo of Amblin Entertainment. They did every Steven Spielberg movie ever. So they were the crew behind this one. It was produced and released by Warner Brothers Studios on a budget of $19 million, and it grossed $64 million worldwide. So it did pretty good. This film was also selected into the National Film Registry in the United States in 2017 for being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. So it's inside their registry. So I, you know, pretty important.
Hey, you
movie.
Guys.
Yeah. Slots. Hey, you history. Guys.
Quite well, significant. That makeup alone is significant. It stars, I'm going to rattle through all these because when we do these group movies, I like mentioning everybody. Sean Astin as Mikey, Josh Brolin as Brand. This is his feature film debut, Josh Brolin, by the way. Corey Feldman as Mouth, Jeff Cohen as Chunk, Ki-Hoo Kwan as Data, Carrie Green as Andy, Martha Plimpton as Steph, John Matuzak as Sloth, Robert Davey as Jake, Joe Pantoliano as Francis, and Anne Ramsey as Mama Fratelli. And here's the synopsis for The Goonies. It's pretty simple. A group of young misfits called The Goonies discover an ancient map and set out on an adventure to find a legendary pirate's long-lost treasure. So here's one fun fact I think is worth mentioning. It's really, really great. So John Matuzak's makeup, so for Sloth, took 5 hours to complete. One of the eyes was the eye was mechanically operated off screen by remote control. So someone would count down and Matuszak would blink his other eye in sync with the countdown with the person off screen. So and also the cast was told you cannot get him wet in scenes outside of the pirate ship scene. So they're like, we'll figure it out on the day, but you can't get him wet any other time. And because when he got wet, the mechanical eye wouldn't work properly.
Oh, they're going to say it electrocuted him or something.
Or, yeah, or like it like would shrink on him and suffocate him or something.
So in terms of reviews, pretty decently well reviewed at the time. It has 76% on Rotten Tomatoes. Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars. And this is what he said about it. The Goonies is a smooth mixture of the usual ingredients from Steven Spielberg action movies, made special because of the high energy performances of the kids who have the adventures. During Goonies, I was often exhilarated by what was happening. Afterward, I was less enthusiastic. The movie is totally manipulative, which would be okay, except it doesn't have the lift of a film like E.T., so it has the high energy without the sweetness, which I just took that quote because do you guys agree with that?
Well, it's not as polished. It's a rough movie. Almost everybody yells through all their lines from start to finish. It's raw.
It's like this podcast before we edit it. It's just like, we're just like screaming and saying shit over and over again. Yay!
It feels more like the movie is like a sequence of memorable scenes and events than a coherent total piece. Whereas E.T., there's like a real arc and there's a real like satisfying ending.
Okay, so the next part, Omari, is we like to do something called the elevator pitch. You listened to the podcast before, so you kind of get the premise. But the idea is, in like 30 seconds to a minute, just kind of pitch the idea of this movie.
This is a story about a group of friends who go on a fantastical adventure to save their town.
What if I were to ask you again if you were to say that sentence and it was like a feeling was the thing on the end of it?
This is, what's the sentence? Say again.
Like if I was doing like Sophie's Choice, I'd be like, this is a story about loss and grief and overcoming adversity or something.
This is a story about wonder and perseverance and bucking against, raging against the machine.
Ooh. Yeah, fuck the man. Fuck the man.
Nonconformity, right?
Hello, little guys.
Now you've got our money.
You have our capitalist money to make your non-capitalist pirate film.
Yeah.
So we're going to get down to it here, where we're going to step through the three instances in the film that we said, no way. But before we do that, we're going to do the givens to establish rules of the world that won't factor into our no ways. We only have 2 givens for the Goonies. The first given is going to be all of the pirate booby traps, all the technology that goes into, you know, the rocks falling and the piano made of bones. We're just going to allow that stuff works somehow, and that's a given. The second given is all of Data's tech and inventions and punch glove... Yeah, it's heavy air quotes tech. It's super inconsistent. What's the size of his trench coat? But we're just going to say that that's a given and his stuff works. Omari, is there anything before we step into the no ways that you think should be considered a given that we haven't mentioned?
That we shouldn't challenge, we just accept it as it is?
That you would say this should be a rule of the world going into the debate.
Well, we can't in any way question the competence or lack of presence of any authority figures or adults at any point because the movie would just go into the toilet from the opening scene.
Kids suck.
That's like a given of the podcast, I feel like. Every single episode we're like, and the authority figures are inept or just not there at all.
I would say that's a good one, and I don't think it's going to affect anything that we've settled on. So we'll also include the ineptitude of authorities and or adults in general.
That is a big theme on our podcast, is like adults and like law enforcement are just terrible at their jobs, which, you know, I think we can joke about. But I think growing up and getting older, I've kind of realized that's actually kind of the truth. It's like a given. Yeah, exactly. It's the given of our entire world. So we can't even really poke holes at it. We like to say, I wish those parents were more responsible. But I think it's all away in our general world right now.
I'm going to share a quick story, and I'll use this guy's name because he's an old buddy of mine. But I went to high school with a guy named Brent Pitino.
Vila Scalapin.
And Brent Pitino was the class clown. And I remember, for some reason, I remember he used to put like two straws in his nose and like play an instrument, like a nose straw instrument. Just like hilarious guy. And I remember one day taking a flight on Air Canada, and he was the pilot. And I was like,
holy shit.
No one, it's all a free for all.
A bottle of Fettuccine in 1981.
It was like this moment. I was in my late 20s, but I had this realization. I was like, nobody knows what's going on. There's nobody behind the wheel of anything. Everybody, like adults are just crazy people who grew up.
We're all just pretending like the way we thought adults looked when we were kids. We're just trying to do that as best as we can. And that's just the generational loop.
This is ridiculous. It's crazy. I feel like I'm babysitting, except I'm not getting paid.
Well, I think we should jump in.
Let's do it.
Round one. I've got the first No Way. We all know the movie, but basically to give a little context up to this point, the Goonies is the Goonies, the group, have all gathered at Mikey's house. They're hanging out. They're having a good time. Mikey mentions there's a lot of exciting stuff in the attic. They go up there. They're rummaging around. And Mikey finds a treasure map of the local area.
What are you doing?
Hey, Mike found the map.
Yeah.
Hey, look, that says 1632. Is that a year or something?
My no way is that there's no way that a treasure map of the local area with a decoder key alongside it ends up in the reject section of the museum's exhibits. Basically going that Mikey's father runs the museum, or at least he probably curates it to some extent. There's all these rejects up there. You've got a museum of the local area. This is like, what's a better exhibit to have in the museum than an ancient treasure map showcasing this region?
Why do you think this map would be up here in this attic when it could be in some safety deposit box?
Here's going back to what something that we discussed earlier. I say way because adults are by and large incompetent. I think it is highly credible that somebody just would have no clue what he had there and was like, what is this old dusty thing? This isn't that important. Yeah. And just like kind of put it aside and then never go back to it. And then it sort of ends up in the attic and they don't realize what it is. But the kids were kind of nerdy and into that stuff. They see it and they're excited by this kind of thing. So they see the value. But an adult just went, oh, this is poppycock.
You sound just as corny as dad does.
Totally hear you. And I remember thinking that too, where I'm like, yeah, for sure. They're like, whatever. It's a fun pirate map. We're going to live up there. We're going to put these owl pellets in the fucking museum or this horn that we found. Except for the fact.
I love that exhibit. I love the
love
horn.
Owl
the
pellets.
Horn and pellet exhibit.
Yeah.
Owl throw up. I love it.
The
yeah.
Animal vomit where you're like, look, they ate a different animal.
They ate something.
What do you eat? But the thing is, Omari, though, I'm with you, except for the fact that at the end of the movie, Mikey's father, the same one who has this thing in the reject bin, immediately accepts the value of those jewels from that bag.
Dad, it's my marble bag. The Fratellis forgot to check it.
So like he accepts that there is treasure in this place, that they found it. And as like a curator or an appraisist, I guess if that's a word, an appraisist, an appraisal man.
An appraiser.
He clearly has some ability to know what's important and what's not. He just takes those jewels at the end. So it's shocking that he just gives up on the map.
There'll be no more signing today.
I also just want to jump in here because I hear that too, Omari. But I mean, wouldn't it also take an idiot adult to go after a treasure
yeah,
in the first place?
Right.
Like, I mean, I think you're right. If a smart intellectual person came across a treasure map, the first immediate thing is this isn't real and this is ridiculous.
You guys, this map is old news.
Which Josh Brolin plays that part in that, you know, that part right there. I mean, though, but if this guy's a little kooky, a little crazy, a little dumb, you get a treasure map, you know, aren't we reverting back to, I should find this treasure because this thing exists. I'm just going to throw that out there as a possibility here.
I want to piggyback in here too, because I'm going to keep pushing the no way. I think it's no way. And it's not even because of Mikey's dad. Not entirely saying that he's culpable, is that, but there is a legitimate treasure map that also has the decoder key.
The rock and the restaurant all fit the doubloon.
And we know that it took about an hour to find the first stop, which was the restaurant. It's just written in Spanish. You know, you can get that translated easily.
Clark, can you translate?
Si no hace buen trabajo.
Like, it's just in Spanish. And the restaurant was very easy for them to find. Is that someone didn't try to go that far, but instead went, let's frame it, and that's it. And now leave it as a framed item. It just seems absurd to me because it's not a difficult map. And yet someone got stumped so fast and then just framed it. And then on top of that is Mike saying, and then it didn't even make it into the exhibit. It's a treasure map of the local legend.
So I'm gonna double back here. What's that? You know that the Genovese effect? You guys ever hear about this? Where it's like... So apparently, if like a crazy crime happens, this, I think, and we'll look this up after, there was a woman named Kitty Giovizzi in New York who was attacked in broad daylight in New York. And people heard her screaming and they're all looking out the window and nobody called the police. And at the time, they talked about how this was a sign of how uncaring people were and it's awful. But then the psychologist was like, no, actually, if a bunch of people have see something horrific or have access and the chance to do something, everyone assumes that somebody else did it and nobody does anything. So I'm going to argue that maybe he was like, obviously this isn't real. This is, there's not huge barriers to find this. It's not that far away. This is cute that somebody made up this treasure map, but like, clearly it's not real or else somebody would have found it by now.
You sound just as corny as dad does.
That's my argument.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that actually makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I like that idea that because it is so old and stuff too. It's like, you would assume someone else has done it.
And it's 1632 was the year on it.
That was the year on it? I'm with Chunk. Was that, what did 1632 mean?
1632.
Yeah, okay. And we do have a pirate expert amongst our podcast
that
here
is true.
Today with Kayvon Koshkam. So the pirate expert, that 1632 is in that window frame of where pirates were at their height, correct?
Especially on the east coast of North America, coming off of the Caribbean loop. So there would have been a lot of pirates stealing from the Spanish armadas.
Oh,
and
yeah,
the British
Omari,
armadas.
It's fucked up, but it's true.
I went down a rabbit hole. I read some books on pirates. Anyways, so the pirates would have more predominantly been taking from the channel from the Caribbean where the, you know, Spanish and the English were robbing and stealing, and they would have intercepted them there, and then they usually went north to spend it and stash it. So it makes sense that the coast of Oregon perhaps is a little too far, but yeah, they'd be up there.
That all being said,
Omari wants to talk to you about my pirate.
Yeah, I know. I want to hear what he has to say.
It was just one of these fascinating things where I was like, either you know way more about pirates than humanly is normal, or you're totally full of shit and you're putting me on. Because I'm like, there was such conviction and ease with what you were, I was saying. I was like, is he messing with me? But you guys seem like you've accepted it. So I guess you're a pirate expert.
Oddly enough, it comes up more than you'd think, needing pirate knowledge.
In kids' movies? Yeah, it comes up a lot.
In kids' movies, there's a lot of pirates in kids' movies.
Okay, so 1632, that checks out. Okay, and then... I see what Omari's saying here is like, since then, we're talking 400 years. Wouldn't you think somebody would have found that treasure by now? Just to get into the detail about this treasure map, does it like, I didn't get a good look at it when I was watching the movie. Does it say like X marks the spot on a location?
It's a series of riddles, isn't it?
No, it's just guiding. It's basically guiding you to the first test of One-Eyed Willie, but it's mostly to be able to find your way get through the restaurant. I guess one of the things I want to track a little bit, and not to take this too long because it's kind of silly to do this, but we know that, what's his name? Chesapeake Chad?
Chester Copperpot.
There's clearly three tools that were necessary to discover this. The map, the decoder key, and the key.
And which the Lou Gehrig baseball card.
And the Lou Gehrig baseball card. But the actual skull key that they used to turn the wall. So... somehow, the guy that they find dead, who has the key that they need, he must have had the map and the decoder key at one point to be able to find, to get him that far. For some reason, that guy didn't, like, he found the restaurant and then left the map and the decoder key behind, and then went down with the skull key. So somebody picked up the map and the decoder key after he disappeared. This is the moment where I'm confused. This guy disappears. There's a map and a decoder key left behind. The last thing he said was, I'm off to go find the treasure. And somebody grabs this thing and doesn't go after him and just frames it. And it ends up in an attic.
Yeah, wait a minute, Mikey.
So, and you're saying that they should have found it and gone and been like, oh, I'm going to go find it because this guy's
missing. And he said, I'm going to go. It's in the newspaper. It's in the paper. He said, I have the key to One-Eyed Willie's treasure. So he must have had the map at one point to figure out where that was. And then he had the key. So why, when he went missing and they found the map and the decoder key, did nobody follow up? Yeah, that confuses me.
I have a bit of a conspiracy theory on this, I think. Because I bet those wealthy elite own the museum. And I have a feeling that there's no way these tunnels haven't been discovered before, because there's clearly sewage piping and it's right below the well. So someone has been through, the public have been through these tunnels
before. That's true.
Like, this is not the first time anyone's been up besides treasure hunters. The public
has
had to be.
There's piping in there.
But I think that the wealthy elite in that town know this treasure exists. And that they have done everything in their power to prevent the general public from finding it, because they know then that they won't have money anymore.
Come to mama, baby. Come on.
And so,
why don't they just take the money and put it in the
bank? They have been. They've been taking a bit at a time, just a bit at a time.
Oh, God. Okay, Mike. Oh, Mike, you always find really great arguments, and then you teeter over.
Wait a minute, Mikey.
That's it. If you take too much at once, if you take too big a slice of the pie, everyone's going to notice. If you just take one pepperoni at a time, everyone thinks it's a cheese pizza is all you got anyways.
Be the scallopine.
I invented that. I want to keep that quote forever.
And I'm going to support Mike for a second. I'm just going to go with this.
Yes, come on my crazy ride.
So this is their vault, he's saying. And he's going, this is their vault. And they're just drawing from it slowly. And it's like a town-wide conspiracy to hide this.
They keep the map out of the museum because they're like, nah, don't put the map in the museum. It's a weird old map. We don't want that in the museum. They don't want it in the museum because then people are going to find their fucking vault.
There's 50 more houses to tear down after yours.
So Mike's dad goes to the owner of the museum. He goes, this has got to be front row center. Check out this find. Owner of the museum, who's in on this, goes, oh, you old clown. That's a myth.
That's just a tea-stained rag.
I hate when we get on these coaster rides with
too
Mike.
Far.
It's too
but
far.
The part about the tunnels.
But I liked what you started with, which is that the wealthy elite in this town, the country club crowd, would diffuse or suppress interest in looking into that, because it would, as Omari's pointed out, this is a Rage Against the Machine element of this movie, that it would put an imbalance of wealth in the community, and they no longer would be the elite, and everybody would have wealth.
You're looking at the richest people in Astoria.
So I can buy that they don't want to encourage pursuit of this wealth. I don't buy that they have a hidey door and they're going in every other day and grabbing a couple jewels and gems from time to time. I think that Chester Copperpot obviously had possession of the map, the decoder, and the key, and he went off, told everybody, because it was in the paper, he went missing, and then the map and the decoder was left behind and someone found it, and I'm in no way that there was no follow-up. And that the decision from that point forward was just to frame it and call it a rejected curated item for a museum. So I'm no way.
Yeah, I think I'm staying on a no way. I think even after, I think Kayvon, you just brought up for me, which is at the time that it was found after he gone missing, I think somebody would have followed up. You're exactly right. Yeah, I'm going to stay a no way.
Okay, I'm gonna no way, but with a qualifier. Here's my no way is, there's no way that this is the first time they explored their parents' attic to find this thing. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. Of course.
That also bugged me. I was like, really? Kids never went up to dad's attic?
That's filled with pirate gear and cool science stuff. And so there's no way. I think they would have found the map before, but for different reasons than what we talked about. Because if it's up there, there's no way they just discovered it now.
No way.
Round two.
Okay, so I'm going to move us forward into the film. This is the scene we're going to watch is at 1 hour, 7 minutes, and approximately 15 seconds. At this point in the film, we've met Sloth. Sloth is still chained to the wall, and Chunk has been captured by the Frenettis?
Fratellis.
And he's now also chained next to Sloth. So we're going to watch that scene right now.
You want a candy bar?
You do now.
Oh, look, I got a baby Ruth, sir.
So I want to sort of say that we've been watching these characters for about an hour, and Chunk is a child of hearty appetite. Chunk is always asking them for snacks, for candy. In the moment of fear, is completely distracted by a cellar full of ice cream.
I smell ice cream.
And that's the priority.
They got pralines and cream, and they got Mississippi mud.
Getting food for Chunk is number one, and Chunk has been screaming about going home to eat dinner this entire time.
And they got chocolate eruption!
There's no way Chunk has an uneaten chocolate bar in his pocket at this point in the film. There's no way he didn't eat that chocolate bar already.
It's so good.
Why don't we just pour chocolate all over the floor and let Chunk eat his way through?
This is one of the simplest ones we've ever had on this podcast.
It's one of my favorite no ways we've ever had.
I can't argue that. I can't argue again. I thought you were going to say he wouldn't give it to him, but you went, he wouldn't have it. Unless he forgot, but they don't make a compelling case.
He's been screaming at everybody to give him food.
And they got apple, and they got grape.
That's legitimately like a product placement. Like, Baby Ruth paid them to put that in the movie. It unravels if we're following the character motivation and what we know about the character.
Absolutely.
You're right. I'm with you. I'm a solid no way.
I mean, okay, so here we go. Because we try to.
So the wealthy elite keep putting chocolate bars in his pocket without his knowledge.
Chunk is a wealthy elite. This is, okay, this is my thing. If you are a person, okay, as Chunk is, would you not at all times keep a backup just in case when you're like, because, you know, I think there's a level of like having some self-control of like, this baby Ruth is for emergencies.
Baby!
And at least I know emergencies. And I'm keep trying to ask people throughout the movie if they have food, because I don't want to eat my food. I would rather eat your food because I get to keep my food. So he's seeking out other people's
but they're
food
not,
for
but
free.
But they didn't give him any.
I know.
But it never worked. And also, if this isn't an emergency, well before this point, I don't know what a Chunk emergency is.
Hi, sir.
You know me. I usually can craft some sort of a story as to why it would happen, but I'm drawing a fucking blank here. Like, I even remember when I was in elementary school, we'd go to the 7-Eleven, and I'd get some fried chicken and some, like, little potato tots, and I'd put them in my cargo pants for later, and I was like, I'm going to save...
What's a potato tot?
I don't know. You know what I mean. Potato tot, I guess.
It's like potato a shit hawk when you eat them.
it's what came out of the shit hawk's butt. I'd eat it later. You know, it's an owl pellet. But I would keep those in my cargo pants pockets so I could eat them. I would say, I'm going to eat these.
So do you have loose tater tots in your cargo pants?
Yeah, like Napoleon Dynamite?
Yes, I did. This is before Napoleon Dynamite.
You're such a Regina kid.
I kept them in my pocket. But the thing was, I'd always planned to have them by near the end of the day, and they'd never make it. I'd eat them as soon as I sat back down in that classroom. So, like, I got fucking nothing. Like, there's no way he didn't eat that shit.
Most kids struggle with delayed gratification. Like,
totally. There's no fucking way he didn't eat that chocolate bar.
My mom sent me to a summer camp for fat kids. And then once during lunch, I got nuts and I pigged out and they kicked me out.
I think I'm hearing the most consistent no way we've ever introduced on the show, but I'm going to do a final lap. We'll go Mark and Michael Murray.
Yeah, it's no way. He would have eaten that within 5 seconds that it went in his hand. There is no way he held that onto that thing.
Yeah, there's no way. If I recall correctly, he ate ice cream in front of a dead man, so I don't think anything's going to stop him from fucking snacking.
Yeah, it's a solid no way. The guy, he's a guy who acts on impulse. He can't control himself, so he'd never delay eating that.
And God bless him for that quality, too.
No way!
Do you know what I love about this no way that we found, though, is that, like, it's really pure. Like, it's just so clean, but it's also it's such a great diagnosis of a character. Like, we understand Chunk so well that we right away we were like, what are you doing? Chunk would never do that.
Yeah, this goes against the Chunk you told me about.
Maybe Chunk is dead.
Okay, wow. So that was a quick round. That was clean. We are in the situation here, Omari, with the Goonies, that both no ways have remained no ways. So what we're going to offer is we got two no ways. We're going to the third round. This last round will count for two. So it's, you know, it's a double. And if it goes away, then we got ourselves a tie. We call it a devil's avocado for some funny reason. But if it goes no way, then it's a hard loss for the Goonies all around. Does it sound good for you?
Meaning that the Goonies is considered trash if it goes no way?
No. We all know we love this film so deeply. Just
Kayvon, if I may, I'd go to the film registry in the States and I pull it off the shelf and I put it in the garbage. Yeah, that's what happens. Yeah, I go to the National Film Institute.
Puts it in the reject bin up in the attic. We take it out of the Criterion collection.
Okay, I'm biased. I want to fight for the honor of Goonies.
You Goonies!
I'm the third no way, and we're going to come in at this no way at an hour 45:15. So this one comes right at the ending of the movie. Just to give you a little run in here, of course, the kids have found the treasure. They fought off the bad guys. They escape through the tunnel that was falling down. They come walking onto a beach. All the police and the parents all come. We have a happy reunion, and we see this scene.
Sorry, Dad. We had our hands on the future. We blew it to save our own lives. Sorry.
It's all right. You and Brand are home safe with your mom and me. That makes us the richest people in Astoria.
So we just watched Mikey admit to his dad that we had the money in our hands and we let it go with a lot of disappointment. My no way is that Billy and the kids give up on their homes in that moment when the threat, which is the Fratellis, are gone and they know exactly where the treasure is. All they got to do is point and they're rich. There's no way that they would give up in that moment. I don't understand why.
Did they not explain in the movie why they couldn't go back and just get it? Oh boy.
I feel like the movie kind of says like they left because they were being chased. The rocks were falling, so there was physical danger happening. In that moment. But it doesn't,
I assume, you know. The idea was that it had like caved in and it was all lost now because it had collapsed on itself. So they were like, again, I thought that was my assumption.
No, that's I think you're right in that. I think that's what the movie is telling us.
Except if the whole town knows and there's that much money at stake, you know, you rent a couple heavy machinery, you know, and you dig it out.
Get a sloth on board.
Yeah, what confuses me is, I mean, obviously Mikey in particular is such a Rudy Rudiger through this whole film, and he rallies everybody time and time and time again. He gets everybody to commit to the adventure, to saving the town, to saving their homes.
We can't go. We can't leave all that gold. That's our future.
And then they clearly flee because they're in danger from the Fratellis, and there's, you know, they're going to get hurt and guns. And then they see the Fratellis get arrested. And in that
so moment, they got out.
But they know exactly, even if they couldn't go back through the side of the mountain, they can just track their path back through the restaurant again. They know exactly how to get through it all. All the booby traps have been set off. They know where the piano room is. Like, it's pretty easy to go back through again. That they don't go, hey, Dad, don't sign that paper because there's like $1 billion on a pirate boat back there and now there's no threat.
We blew it to save our own lives.
Is the treasure at the end of the film on the pirate boat still that's sailing away, or did they get it out and it's in there?
Well, I mean, it's in the pirate boat, but the pirate boat at that point has not left.
Yeah, yeah.
We should have that moment where Mikey is saying that, exactly what Kayvon just said, of like, Dad, we gotta, there's a treasure in there, and all the kids going like, there's a fucking treasure, don't sign it. And like, to me, that's kind of what happens with the jewels, but not quite.
Ay, Dios mío de mi vida. Ave María Purísima, mira nomás.
But like, isn't that a satisfying ending where the kids are like, Dad, we saved the day. We got the treasure. We don't need to sign. He rips it up. We're good. And they're rich. I don't know.
But it felt like what they were trying to say is that the moral of the story is you're rich if you have a family who loves you.
That makes us the richest people in Astoria.
So they went, home will be wherever we move. The rich people can have this shithole.
Yeah, except that kid's moment is, going to go through a lot of counseling if it hadn't ended different, was, sorry, we chose our lives over the money.
Data's dead. Data fell into a pit and he tried to use a fucking, a grapple gun, but he's a child. It didn't work. He fell onto spikes, Mom.
I think what you're right is that the writers wanted to manufacture a moment to show that they didn't need to find wealth for the families to remain happy. But I still don't see, what would have sold me on it? They would have seen the boat just fucking sail off like they do. And then they go, I guess it is gone. And then Dad goes, don't worry, we don't need that. But because they haven't resolved it, he's just so like, it's just around the corner. Like, we walk through the sand, follow the footprints.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they could have even said the Fratellis, like we fought them off. And then, oh my God, there we are. There they are.
And they've been bad.
I'm telling the truth. There's treasure right there.
Also, they got out, so there's clearly a way.
Yeah, right. They did escape the same thing.
I know. I think that's what they were implying, is that everything imploded and it's gone. But then the Fratellis come out. It's like, clearly they're fine, and we thought they were dead. There was a path. There's an air hole. There's a space. And that is confirmed by then the ship leaving, being like, this actually was completely, it cleared itself, actually. The whole thing fell down and actually made a perfect entrance into that cave.
Well, I'll be damned.
Well, I guess that's the even stronger argument. If there was enough space and enough of it left that the boat could leave in good shape, then clearly...
fucking cool pirate ship left. There's no way back in. Yes, the pirate ship left, but there's no way back in.
Actually, can we even rewind even further? Like, they could just follow the trajectory on the water of where the boat exited from.
Oh, I don't know why everybody isn't grabbing Coast Guard, or whether there aren't four Coast Guard boats and a helicopter chasing down this treasure boat.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're at Cauldron Point and what appears to be a pirate ship.
They're all too. Just waving. Bye, boat.
Okay. Any modern ship, even in the 80s, could catch up to that thing, no problem. It's just an ancient pirate ship, right? Like, you're right.
For me, I'm just hung up on, again, this is a character thing, is they've established Mikey's a fighter, and Mikey's goal is to save the Boondocks and save their homes and make sure that they get to stay in the community and stay the Goonies.
Goonies never say die!
And there's nothing standing in his way from saying, Dad, don't sign that. The treasure's right there. The bad guys have been caught. We can just go back and get it.
You've made my day.
Here's my counter, though, right? And I could mess this up. It's not that Mikey's a fighter. He's pure of heart and like righteous in what he fights for. So when he realizes that like money isn't the answer, which, by the way, thematically, it doesn't work because the answer at the end of the movie is literally money.
Dad, it's my marble back.
That's a whole other conversation. But they're trying to say that he's going, we don't need money anymore, so that's not my fight. We're good. It just doesn't work. If I was a director with any degree of pull, I would have pushed back on that ending big time, because I would have told them, I know what you're trying to land in terms of theme, but what you're actually saying is capitalism is the only way and money saves the day, because that was your solution.
There'll be no more signing today.
Yeah, and and what this moment is of them becoming passive for a moment on the pursuit of wealth to land a beat of like what we landing a beat of George Bailey, like life is rich if you have family. It's so minute and it flies in the face of what they've been doing up to this point. And then immediately, as you say, becomes again, it's good. No, because they have money again. Like, it just is so unearned. It collides with the character's trajectory.
And you have the lowest class member in this story, the immigrant housekeeper, be the one who gives the wealth back to these people as well. Like, she does, like, oh, why doesn't
who has
she
been
keep
threatened by Corey Feldman quite aggressively?
Why doesn't she keep those fucking jewels and run? Instead, she's like, I should help you guys. You're like, Jesus Christ.
I don't think we want to even start picking that thread.
I am a no way. It doesn't make sense.
I wanted to fight with this movie. I wanted to fight. I wanted like the kids fight for their home. But then guess what? They give up at the end. And there is no way that that would be what they would do. And we've just identified two major character flaws that flies in the face of what these characters have been told, that been told to the audience, like who they are, what they stand for. And if Mikey's got a chance to save his house, God damn it, he's going to do it. And it's right around the corner. It's literally right there. He can say there's treasure, and for some reason just doesn't do it. It's a no way.
It sounds like we're doing a final lap, and I agree with it. It's just like the whole movie is like, it's almost like video game levels, and the characters keep wanting to give up except Mikey. So it just makes no sense to me that at the end, Mikey is the one who gives up. I'm really trying to rack my brain as to why he's feeling that way in that moment. Is he like...
They won.
Is he scared of hurting his friends again? Is he just like, you know what? A couple of us almost died down there. Like, we do give up on this. I've grown up in that time, and I learned, like, we don't need the money. Fuck it. It's too dangerous. Is that what he's saying? Like, that... I don't know.
He doesn't have to go in again.
I know. Just send the sheriffs. It's just a no way in that moment that he doesn't bring up the treasure right there.
Yeah, I gotta go with no way also. It's sad, but you're right. It just doesn't make sense. And even if I tried to, like, you know, play devil's advocate, I can't really make a compelling argument for why they don't just try to get it in some way. It makes no sense.
No way.
Coming back to, as an adult, watching this movie through, it's a disjointed movie for me. It was before my time, before I was born, so I don't have a strong connection to this movie in a nostalgia way. And then watching as an adult, I was just like, this is fun. For sure, I love Steven Spielberg. There's a lot of great images. I love Sloth, and I love the boys dynamic. I think that's a lot of fun, but I can probably name you about 5 to 10 movies who do the same thing at a better level for me at the time. So I'm gonna go with I don't want to give it a failing grade, so I'm gonna just give it a 50. I'm gonna say it a 50 with this one.
50?
Don't say that. Never say that.
50.
You schmuck.
My Gen X heart is just reeling.
50? You guys,
Oh,
yeah.
Fuck you.
Fuck me.
You smell like fizzette.
I don't know. I was watching. Okay.
Oh. No, it's fine.
Wait.
It's okay,
no.
50.
Let me also, I watched this in preparation for this podcast on a plane to Vancouver to Winnipeg at 8:30 a.m. So I think that state of mind of just being really tired on a plane with a mask on was informing the way I was watching this movie. So I wasn't doing the laughing. I wasn't having a great time. And I think that's why it's informed where we're at.
We all appreciate your commitment to the podcast. Thank you for putting that time into watching the film.
Is that all?
See, that's so interesting to me that you just said that, Mark, because I was thinking of something I was going to say, and I was like, nah, I'm not going to bring that up, but now I will, which is that when I watched this for the podcast to prep for it, I was like running on like 4 hours of sleep. I just finished like a 10-hour day at work, and I put it on, and I had that feeling when you sit in the couch and like start watching a movie where you think you're going to doze in and out, and I didn't fucking do it once. I was like hooked on it. Like, it kept my like falling asleep body going, because I was genuinely interested in everything happening. It was a lot of fun having that many kids just fucking screaming and saying shit. Like, I was like, I dig this, because like, unlike Kayvon, I felt very... I feel like I lived those moments a lot with my friends growing up. And it, even though the movie wasn't from my time, I felt like it represented me and my friends as kids better than the movies I watched growing up that were supposed to do that. Yeah, shit, I had a great time with this movie. It's not perfect. It's definitely not perfect to me. But I'd give it like an 82.
It was really... I love this movie. It was a VHS top choice on the rack growing up. Love all the characters, love the story, love the pirates, love the one-liners. There's so many funny jokes in this. The kids are really loud and really earnest. They don't seem like kid performances that I've seen through a Nickelodeon lens as things have progressed. They are, like, I believe that half those lines aren't in the script because they're just yelling over each other constantly. So that's really fun. It felt really honest. This time through, I found myself really I found myself uncomfortable around the love story triangle between Mikey and the older brother and her confusion about who she's...
You know, you keep kissing girls the way you do. The parts of you don't work so good, they're going to catch up to the ones that do.
It really stuck out as an adult, and I was like, what did I think of that as a kid, that it was cute? That thing threw me, but all around, love the whole thing, love the imagery, love the set deck, all that sort of stuff. So I'm going to go 87%.
I love the movie as well. And this was totally my childhood. You know, I'm turning 42 this year, so heavy on the nostalgia. As soon as I heard the music, just those, you know, those electric piano or electric keys, I felt that, you know, whimsical feeling that I had watching movies like Neverending Story or E.T. when I was a kid. It's the idealized adventure that all kids still want to have, I would argue, to this day. And it's even more nostalgia because seeing kids existing in this world where imagination had to play such a big role in having fun and just hanging out with your buddies, right? Where no social media. This was even like pre-video games, right? Like really, like that, like they had like arcade games, but this wasn't really like an era where Nintendo or even Atari were kind of popping. So it was like this time capsule of the last generation where you had to just mess around with your buddies and use your imagination to entertain yourself. So for that, I'll give it 89.
It was beautiful.
Hey, thanks for hanging out. It's always great to have excuses to spend time with you and chat film. And The Goonies was not overly successful in the logic gauntlet, but a winner in my heart, except for Fuckface Markey with his 50. Fuck you, bud.
Yeah, hurtful. Hurtful. Thank you guys for having me. It was really fun.
Thanks, Omari. Well, I've been
thank you for listening to this episode of the No Way Podcast. No Way is produced by Markian Tarasiak, Kayvon Koshkam, and Mike Gill with the help of Speakeasy Theater and the Cinematics Creation Company. The show is edited by Kayvon Koshkam with original music by Ben Elliott. The No Way Podcast is produced on the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. Make sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at No Way Podcast and Twitter at No Way Pod. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time at the movies. I got to let the gypsy dance.